Cavalcade of Kings. William the Fourth. The cavalcade of kings rides on. George the Third and George the Fourth ride at the end of the long procession of royal monarchs, which slowly recedes from sight as the stout little figure of William the Fourth, the sailor king, approaches. He was born at Buckingham Palace on the 21st of August, 1765, and was the third son of George the Third and Queen Charlotte. Rough, garrulous, and diffuse of speech, bustling in his movements, undetermined in character, without much intelligence, but with great good nature and love for his fellow man, William the Fourth was one of England's best beloved sovereigns. As a lad, he joined the navy, and later married Princess Adelaide, the eldest daughter of the Duke of Saxe-Meiningen. It is now the evening of the 25th of June, 1830. King George the Fourth is dying at Windsor Castle. Very early next morning, his brother, William Duke of Clarence, is up pottering about in the garden of his house at Bushey Park, when the Prime Minister, my Lord Duke of Wellington, is announced.
Ahoy there, Your Grace. You're astir bright and early this morning.
I have just come from Windsor Castle, sir.
Windsor Castle? Oh, I trust the King spent a more comfortable night, Your Grace.
The King is dead, Your Majesty.
Dead? Poor George. God rest his soul.
My deepest sympathy, sire, in your sad bereavement. Of course, Your Majesty realizes what this means to you.
Aye, my Lord Duke. And I'm quite ready to assume my responsibilities. I shall be needed in London today.
If it is convenient, Your Majesty's presence will be required at St. James as soon as possible to sign the declaration papers.
I shall be there at 1 o'clock, Your Grace.
Then I shall proceed on my way, sire. The members of the royal family must be acquainted with the intelligence of your accession immediately.
We shall meet again in council, my Lord Duke. Till then, good day to you, sir. Adelaide, are you awake?
Yes, come in, William. From my window, I just saw the coach of the Duke of Wellington turning into the drive. Does he bring news from Windsor?
Yes, Adelaide. The King is dead.
God's will be done. Oh. This, then, is the end of our life of seclusion and simplicity which is so dear to us. Oh, William, I can't bear the thought of all the publicity, the ceremony and fatigue that awaits me as the wife of the King of England.
Now, you must be a brave little woman and help your old William to do his duty to his people. No, no, come, come, my love. Don't cry. Damn it, I hate to see a woman in tears.
You will have to go to London today.
I must be at St. James Palace at 1 o'clock. Now, you'll help me get ready, won't you? That confounded valet of mine would annoy me beyond endurance today. Already he started bowing and scraping. Oh, sickening.
Of course I'll help you, dear. You'd better wear your admiral's uniform. I'll lay it out for you myself.
Oh, I hope I haven't grown too stout for it. Excuse me, Adelaide, but I must hurry.
William, have you thought what all this means?
Yes. It means that the people will have a king who loves his subjects and understands their needs. A king who wants to be their father as well as their lord. A man whose one ambition it is to give them happiness, prosperity, contentment, and, assisted by his ministers, sane government.
Not only sane government, William, but a reformed government. My dear, cheering crowds and smiling faces, dinners, reviews, drawing rooms and state balls will follow in quick succession. You will be a popular monarch, but neither the king's popularity nor the splendor of court ceremonies will blind the vast bulk of the people to the heavy taxation that cripples them.
I mean to put an end to the abuse of power by the privileged classes and to the appalling waste of public money which is responsible for the heavy taxation. The recent revolt of the French, followed by that of Belgium, has shown me that example is the most powerful incentive.
Indeed, yes. And I fear this irrepressible dissatisfaction and unrest which is at the moment stirring England might, under prolonged strain, burst into civil war.
Well, that's a condition which can easily be avoided.
How, William?
I'll tell you, my dear. One interest alone, that of the landed proprietors, is adequately represented in Parliament. Commerce, shipping, the great industries that have brought power and wealth to this kingdom have little or no voice in Parliament. And so, the great landowners have held the whip hand. They've only supported the laws that have suited them and thrown out the others. It's high time that all towns and that all branches of the community, as well as commerce and industry, had full and proper representation in the government. That is what I mean to fight for. If the government reform bill is passed, peace and contentment will return to our people.
The Reform Act was passed after great opposition from Wellington and his party. Then followed the abolition of colonial slavery in 1833, the reform of the Poor Laws in 1834, and the Municipal Reform Act in 1835. All these were the result of the great constitutional change which had taken place in England. Wellington, failing to recognize the demand for parliamentary reform in 1830, declared against it, and thus brought about the fall of his government, becoming so unpopular that he was hooted by the mob on the anniversary of Waterloo, and the windows of Apsley House broken by stones. The King and Queen, whilst never shirking their duty, oft times would steal away from the strict routine of the court and spend a few long looked-for hours of rest at Brighton. Here the bluff old sailor king would fraternize without any ceremony with some of the superannuated admirals who had once served with him in the fleet. At the moment, we find their majesties walking unattended along the waterfront. The Reform Act was passed after great opposition from Wellington and his party. Then followed the abolition of colonial slavery in 1833, the reform of the Poor Laws in 1834, and the Municipal Reform Act in 1835. All these were the result of the great constitutional change which had taken place in England. Wellington, failing to recognize the demand for parliamentary reform in 1830, declared against it, and thus brought about the fall of his government, becoming so unpopular that he was hooted by the mob on the anniversary of Waterloo, and the windows of Apsley House broken by stones. The King and Queen, whilst never shirking their duty, oft times would steal away from the strict routine of the court and spend a few long looked-for hours of rest at Brighton. Here the bluff old sailor king would fraternize without any ceremony with some of the superannuated admirals who had once served with him in the fleet. At the moment, we find their majesties walking unattended along the waterfront.
Gad, she's blowing a stiff nor'easter. Better hold on tightly to your bonnet, Adelaide, or else it'll find a watery grave.
The wind is rather strong, isn't it? Oh, look, there's a little fishing boat way out there on the water. It's tossing about like a cork. They're not in any danger, I hope.
Not them. Those men know what they're about. Which reminds me, I'd like a day's fishing.
It would be a pleasant relaxation for you, my dear. Only please don't go out too far. The sea's very rough, and those boats are such frail affairs. Oh, here comes your friend, the Admiral. I'll leave you to talk to him whilst I call upon poor little Mrs. Cross. I want to leave a gift for her new baby. Give my regards to the Admiral.
All right. He'll be charmed to receive them, my dear. Farewell till luncheon.
Try not to be too late. There's a dear man.
Ahoy there, Admiral. Ahoy. How goes the watch, eh?
Well,
come on. Come and sit you down on this bench and let's have a yarn.
Your Majesty is very kind.
Fiddlesticks, and for goodness sake, let's get away from formality for a while. I'm on holidays, man, on holidays.
Men, indeed you earn these brief interludes of rest, sire.
And heartily enjoy them, Admiral. Especially when I meet some of my old cronies. Gad, it takes my mind back through the years when I was a boy sailing the seven seas. Gad, that's the life, sir. The sound of the wind whistling high up in the shrouds, the smell of the sea mists and the sting of the spray. Those were the days, my boy. Those were the days.
It's rumored, sire, that before very long, ironclads will take the place of the old wooden ships.
I hope I never live to see the day when our dear old hearts of oak are dispensed with. Wooden ships have served us nobly and well right from the time of Alfred the Great, the father of the British Navy, until now. It would seem like an act of disloyalty to an old friend to replace them.
I agree with you, sire.
Now take the ships of Alfred.
Great long vessels they were, rowed by 30-odd pairs of oars. Then there was the Great Harry, built by Henry VII, at a cost of 15,000 pounds.
She was accidentally burned, wasn't she, sire?
Yes. Of course, the honor of having laid the foundation of the British Navy as a distinct service really belongs to old Bluebeard.
Bluebeard, sire?
Well, Henry VIII, then. Well, egad, it's past 1 o'clock. The Queen will be waiting for me. Come and have lunch with us, Admiral.
Oh, but, sire, I couldn't intrude upon Her Majesty like this. She may have made plans for this afternoon.
Nonsense. The Queen will welcome you. She does nothing after luncheon but embroider some flowers, and she'll enjoy listening to our conversation. God bless her.
Oh, but, sire, I have no suitable clothing. I haven't a pair of court breeches to me name.
Then come without them, me boy. Come without them.
Oh, Your Majesty.
You know what I mean, damn it. Come on. I'm hungry and I want my lunch.
It is now the 20th of June, 1837, and the 7th year of the reign of William the Fourth, and the 73rd year of his life. He is dying at Windsor Castle. The Queen and the Archbishop of Canterbury are at his bedside.
I've just had some quiet sleep, Adelaide. Come and pray with me, and thank the Almighty for it.
And shall I not also pray to the Almighty that you may have another good day so that you can once more enjoy the glory of the setting sun? You love the splendor of the setting sun, don't you, my darling?
Yes, Adelaide. The glory of it brings hope and encouragement, the promise of better things to come. But I fear I shall never see another sunset. And yet I wish I could have lived another 10 years. Victoria would have been so much older then. Poor child. What a weight of responsibility is soon to fall upon her frail shoulders. My Lord Bishop, please repeat for me the Lord's Prayer.
Thank you.